Hey, Mike.
Hey, Michelle, you changed your picture.
I did.
Your Skype picture looks good.
I did. Oh, thank you. Yeah, I changed some stuff. I'm trying to get, you wouldn't believe the mess I'm sitting in right now. I'm changing everything out in here and doing some other stuff. And it's good problems to have, but I don't know if you've tried to get anything done recently, like with installers or deliveries or whatever, but it is so difficult to get people that come out when they're supposed to and handle things the way they're supposed to and install things. I mean, it's unbelievable to me.
Michelle, this is live action, so don't make any enemies of contractors.
No, the ones I'm working with right now are really, really great, but I'm still like in the middle of a bunch of stuff, but it's okay. It's all going to be okay. Deep breath. We're not talking about that now. We got good things to talk about and bad.
Better call Saul 403, Michelle.
Something beautiful.
403, right? Three?
Yep. 403.
Why did I put talk? Is that the next one? 404?
404 is talk, yeah.
Yeah, okay. All right, so Michelle, do you have any mysterious things that are bothering you about this episode? To ask you a leading question.
Yeah, there was a couple of things. It may just be stuff that I should know and I don't know, but I'm really curious about Gus and what's going on with Gail. Should I know that?
That didn't strike me as mysterious.
Okay.
What's mysterious about it that you wonder about?
What I wonder about is, we'll just get into it when we get there, because it's too much really to go over right now. But I didn't realize that, I don't know, this was like a side thing that Gus maybe has going on or thinking about going on or whatever. But I thought that was a little mysterious. Why? What did you?
Oh, I see. Well, to answer the Gus thing, I see his entire plan being set in stone for us.
Right, but that's what I was asking. Was this something that was going on before? Something he was planning? Something?
Totally planning.
Yeah. Okay. It's not happening yet, though. You don't think it's not already happening? It's just his kind of shepherding things the way he wants them to go.
I think so. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
My mysteries were, why did Kim go to the courthouse? Why did she need to go last-minute decision to go to the courthouse?
Right.
And the banks in the area that Kevin is expanding into are the same area where Kim grew up. The Nebraska/Kansas City, all those regional areas that he wants to put all these new fancy banks in is where she grew up. And the timing of those banks and Mesa Verde, the whole expansion thing seems to be coinciding with the housing crash and all that investment crash that's about to happen. So growing so quickly and so exorbitant, like, why don't they just move into strip mall bank buildings? Why do they, why do they need all these new fancy architectured buildings for a bank? Like, he's over-planning it. He's going to overindulge himself in this growth and cause problems.
That's interesting. I did not put the timeline together with the housing bubble and the crash and all that. So that's really interesting. I had a little bit different take on that with Kim. But we'll talk about all that. It's a lot of stuff.
Like, he had a whole studio room just to show off the models of the banks. A practical blue gray suit banker wouldn't be that exorbitantly artistic, you know. He's like, and it was almost dreamy-ish music playing when Kim was wandering around looking at those models.
Well, and dreamy lighting too, since you said that. It was all very, yeah, that's a good way to put it.
So I don't know if she was dreaming about her past as a kid growing up in that area, or dreaming about this guy being in a dream, like he's dreaming, or dreaming about too much work, or it was kind of mysterious. The whole, it wasn't very bankerish like to show off an artistic room full of models of buildings.
Okay, that's a real interesting take on that, particularly with the timeline and what we know as people in the future is going to happen. So was there anything else?
No, that was just my initial thought of it.
That's pretty interesting. That's interesting.
Cool... Sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
We get to see, well, I was going to say to start, we get to see that cool Cutlass 442 again.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but it doesn't fare well. It's pretty rough. Yeah, we start off, this was really kind of odd to me as we go into this, or not odd, that was the wrong word. It was really telling to me. We alternate scenes in this episode with the very serious. We have the cartel stuff and how serious this is with the lighthearted kind of capers that Jimmy's pulling. And it goes back and forth and back and forth. So, but Jimmy's stuff has like a sense of potential real danger. So anyway, I just thought it was really interesting. So, but yeah, we start off with Gus guys setting up the staged kill of Arturo and forcing Nacho, it looks like, to go along with it. With the spikes being pulled across the road and this... I've never thought about what would happen. I mean, I guess I've seen it in movies and stuff, but this was pretty intense. Like, we gush all the time about the cinematography of this. The way they shoot this is just, it's almost like you feel it. You're in the car, and Gus guy can barely even keep control of the car once he goes across those spots. It's a pretty elaborate scheme to set up.
I like the macro close-up of the spike strip getting dragged across the asphalt and the sound of it,
mm-hmm.
the crunchy kind of metallic sound. I thought that was cool, but I think the car driving over the spike strip at 45 or 50 miles an hour and everything blowing up was embellished.
Okay.
I think you get four flat tires, but your hubcaps don't explode off the wheels.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know. Just the way it hit that, and then your tire going down onto your wheel and how long it took him to gain control of the car. But yeah, you're probably right with that. But we see all that happen, and then we see Nacho driving down the road behind that situation, and they're taking Arturo out of the trunk and putting him in there, and they're just really setting up this whole elaborate thing. And we have to remember here that Arturo was Nacho's friend, too. So this is a rough, rough scene for Nacho in more ways than one. And then here come the cousins, and they had some pretty large caliber weapons that they were firing into that car. But or not the cousins. What am I talking about?
Yeah, Nacho and Tyrus.
Right, right. But they...
Are not Nacho, Victor and Tyrus.
Victor and Tyrus.
Who may be cousins. We don't know that they're not cousins.
Okay, but not the cousins I was thinking. Not the cousins. I'm getting way ahead of myself. But they're pretty scary in this situation, too. And it took me a minute to realize that they don't care if Nacho lives or dies, right? They don't care.
For the most part, I think they're putting on a pretty good scene here. And yeah, if his getting eliminated is a byproduct of us putting on a really good, effective looking scene, then that's collateral damage they're willing to pay.
Sure, because the point is to make Arturo's death not look like a hit, which it was. I mean, it was a retaliation against what Arturo had done, but they can't let the Salamancas know that, the Salamanca team know that in any way. And if Nacho has to pay the price for that, because that was pretty rough. Nacho gets in the car, they shoot him in the shoulder, and he gets out. He's like, can I make the call now? And they shoot him in the gut. And I mean, a gut shot's a pretty serious shot.
Pretty good strategy. And they make all the bullet holes on only one side of the car.
Right.
Like they're being pursued and shot at by another car.
Right.
And then they make the... they drop all the cartridges, the spent shells along the way in a little burst.
Right.
And then Nacho gets out of the side of the car without the bullet holes and walks off in the desert and looks like he's recovering from that battle.
It was a pretty elaborate scene, but they're definitely going to go as far as they need to make this look authentic. And I think, I mean, I guess we knew, but this is pretty, you know, got a lot of detail in it for that. So I think Nacho was definitely in more than he bargained for. They shoot it. They do this gut shot, and then they throw the phone at him and tell him he better make the phone call. And, you know, two bullet holes in him, losing quite a bit of blood, and telling him he better make the phone call before he passes out, and they walk away. And this takes us to the intro, and we come back from the intro, and we started with all this very serious stuff, really scary stuff, and the next scene just seems silly, especially in comparison. It's where Saul's trying to talk Mike into doing the Hummel caper. He's explaining what he wants to do is take the cheaper Hummel that looks very much like the more expensive Hummel. The Merry Wanderer is evidently like a dime a dozen, but the Barbarian Boy looks really similar, and it's rarer and much more expensive. So he wants Mike to break into the Neff copier office and switch out the Merry Wanderer for the Barbarian Boy, and then they'll sell it and make, I guess, $8,000 for it. But Mike doesn't want anything to do with this. He's like, pass, you know, in his typical Mike exaggerated way. He's just perfect.
And you should pass too.
He does tell him that. But Jimmy asks him, would you just walk past $20 on the sidewalk? That's how easy this is. So then I thought it was interesting how Mike brought up Chuck there. You know, I'm sorry about your brother. I think what we're seeing in a lot of this is that people are realizing that maybe Jimmy is doing this kind of stuff in a acting out sort of way.
Yeah, it's kind of regressing back to Slippin' Jimmy days, like little capers versus big scamming the Kettlemans out of the $1.5 million. Now he's going after $8,000 little scams.
Right, right. Very, what was that coin trick that he did for a while? It's very similar to stuff like that.
The Cleveland sunroof.
Oh, yeah, that was a bad one.
Breaking Bad is creeping more and more closely into this too, Michelle, because that meeting was at Loyola's. Well, that's where Mike and Lydia met, and then Lydia wanted them to sit at separate benches and act like they were not together. And then the waitress comes up and says, "Hi, Mike. How are you?" That was the same waitress, Fran, as the one that with Lydia and Mike.
Oh, that's cool. I did know it, or I did think it was the same place. I remember Lydia sitting with her back to him and wanting to talk like that, and Mike's like rolling his eyes at her in Breaking Bad, like, "Are you? You know, come on. They know me here." But I didn't realize it was actually the same.
Yeah, Loyola's.
So Jimmy leaves, and he is calling for Dr. Caldera because he has a very sick fish. Okay, so you know how you've talked about the fish a lot? I mean, we have, and I think this may have some, this may be the fish's importance, right? This fish is like the segue to the criminal element. And we saw that before when he took the fish in and Dr. Caldera was like, don't do that. You've got him, you know, he's going to smother.
But maybe it might be symbolic. I think it's a little bit of overkill. Like, why can't Jimmy just call this guy and talk to him? Why does he need to go in and have the fish as a cover, get the fish checked out? It seems elaborate, but maybe there's a reason behind it that we'll find out later.
I just think it seems silly. It's like, we've got these really serious situations that we know Jimmy/Saul is going to get involved in. And then we have the silliness of the sick fish. It feels like Jimmy is right on the edge. He's like walking this tightrope, but still he's in the silly part of it in place of being in the more serious part. But it's like one wrong move and he's going to fall over. So that makes it a little tense to me, but he's not there yet. Okay, this is where we see the cousins walking down the road and they notice all the detail that you and I just talked about in the first scene and the holes only in one side of the car, and they find Nacho and he's alive, but Man, Nacho's seen better days. No kidding. And they take him. They're asking him who did it, but he doesn't know. He tells them a silver car, maybe a Firebird. And he's really, really rough. They're pouring alcohol on his wound, and then the cousins set the car on fire. After they have really checked everything out, though, you can see these guys. They're really looking at every little detail that's been left for them. And then they're evidently pleased with their knowledge and what happened. They're not questioning anything. They set the car on fire and they leave.
Do you think the cousins are smart, or do you think they're just thugs?
I think they're very smart in what they do. I do think they're thugs, but I think they're very detail-oriented. What do you think?
I don't know if they're smart. I have no reason to believe that they're smart. No evidence has shown us that they're super smart. Their senses work. They can see things and notice things. But maybe they're only noticing the important kind of superficial things. And then they kind of wash the whole scene by wiping it out with fire. So maybe that's all we need to know. But I was just kind of curious if they're, are they super perceptive, or are they just like eyes and ears and senses on the scene for other people to report back that this looked the way it did. It appears, you know.
Right. Yeah, they really showed us that they were paying attention to the little details all the way down to the fragments of stuff like the car would have been shot as it's going down the road. So I'm going to say that even if they're not smart, because thinking about that, I don't know if they're smart, but I think they're good at what they do. I think they're really, really good at this particular thing anyway.
Yeah, those two guys are interesting. They're almost like machines. Like, we don't really know any personalities of them. We don't know their personalities. They're just like sensors, receptors, taking in information and executing jobs that people give them. And they're like almost robots.
Yeah, yes, yes, very Terminator-ish. They're just mission-oriented and just very focused on the one thing. But you're right, we don't see any kind of personality with them at all. And then we get to the scene where Kim is walking into Mesa Verde, and she has a paralegal, Viola, now. So what do you think about that?
Well, I think they're trying to show us that Kim's taken on way too much for what she can handle. She's still got her arm in the cast. Viola's going to help her, but now she has to kind of check on Viola, too. She has to make sure her work is... I don't know. I think Kim's getting frazzled and overworked, and Kevin gives her this credit for, like, helping him think big. I think this pressure is just totally building up on Kim.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. She's talking... But then Kevin comes in. They're in the meeting. Kevin comes in, and he insists they're on a timeline. Everything is like they need to get stuff done, and he insists that she go look at the models of the planned expansion. And so you're right. They go into that room, and there's, you know, the music and the lighting, and it's a whole room of this place dedicated to the various planned expansions. And it is funny because they were talking about where Kim was from, but they also talked about everywhere, Salt Lake City, Cheyenne, Nebraska, Utah, Sedona, Colorado, Reno, Las Vegas. They go on and on. Basically, Kevin mentions every city in the world, in the U.S., out west. And he's continuing. He's showing, you know, pointing out each one. So it's pretty big. Their expansion is aggressive, like you were saying.
Yeah, and he does make a point of saying that your work has got me thinking big. So that's a huge weight for Kim, especially if something goes wrong with that thinking big and growing too quickly.
Yeah, I've got a little bit different take on Kim. Kim checks out while Kevin's talking. She's like going somewhere else, and he's really gung-ho, and Kevin makes a comment that this is what it's all about. And I felt like when he said that, and everything else, that it kind of stops Kim in her tracks. I think Kim is realizing that this is not what it's all about. Her car wreck, because she was trying to do so much, she almost lost her life. Chuck's death, trying to take Jimmy down. I've got kind of a different take on Viola, too. I think she's there because Kimmy is realizing that it's just not her life. It's not everything. It's not worth as much as she has been willing to and seen everybody else put into it.
What do you think she's wanting to be other than a hot, fast-track lawyer?
I don't know that she has even thought that far, maybe. I just think that she's feeling like that there's more to life and that all this stuff is seeming more and more superficial to her as the more important things in life come up. We see it, of course, in the end with Jimmy and the letter and stuff, but...
Well, Kevin does make it sound like this is an endless journey. This expansion into everything, every city, everywhere is like endless. There's no, okay, we're done with North Platte. Now we're going to Reno. Now we're going to Portland. Like, there's no end to it. Like, that may be overwhelming to Kim, too.
I'm sure that it would be overwhelming. But this would be if she were how a lot of lawyers would be in a situation like that. This would be the springboard to her owning her own firm, because Kevin's not going to expect her to do all this by herself. I mean, she's going to have to get people in there. She's already taken on somebody. So she could own her own firm of lawyers that just worked with Mesa Verde.
Could be, but I think you're right about her just not liking the... It's not the path that she probably thought. Like, the path is becoming more clear to her, and it's not the one that she thought. She doesn't like the looks of it.
I agree. That's exactly what I think. And then as they're leaving, Viola brings up that she's offering to help Kim with these different things, and Kim's like, okay, well, you tried. Because as they were walking in, Kim was saying, I'll do that part. You just proofread it, so to speak. And as they're walking out, she's like, you know what? You do it, and I'll proofread it. So she's given her more and more responsibility. And you're right. Then she talks about being dropped off at the courthouse. And I don't know what that's about. But we do see in the upcoming a little bit, maybe. Spoiler alert.
Well, what do you see?
We just see Kimmy sitting in the courthouse. It looks like in a room, you know, like listening to a trial room. She looks like she's sitting in the spectator, you know, the family section or whatever. So I don't know. Okay, then we see Jimmy. He's at the vet office. The doctor's in the back on his phone, and Jimmy goes in and just completely takes the conversation over. That was interesting, right?
Do you think this vet, Joe DeRosa, is the guy that knows a guy that knows a guy? Do you think he's in that chain of guys?
Oh,
because okay. He knows all these guys. He knows Price, the slim slam man with the pills from earlier seasons. Now he knows this other guy that does the smash and grab to replace Mike. He knows all these guys.
He may be the guy.
And maybe Jimmy, I guess I maybe think that Jimmy sees a model for himself in this guy, Joe DeRosa. What's his name? Calypso or Caldero or something.
Caldera,
He sees himself like, I could do this. This guy has all these connections. I don't need this guy. I could do this. So Jimmy now knows all these guys, the Disappearer and... I don't know. I think he might have seen a future for himself potentially, because eventually this guy says, I'm out of this cartel crap. Like, he doesn't want to be, he's in too deep or something. He wants the simple smash and grab stuff, but not this cartel stuff. And maybe this is an opportunity Jimmy, maybe we learn that this is an opportunity Jimmy sees to move into something more dangerous and maybe more profitable. And there's a reason this silly vet guy knows all these people, I think. But this was an interesting scene. Yeah. So I like the way that, and then the interesting cross of the cousins coming in as Jimmy's going out.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Jimmy, I think, is realizing, although I'm sure that he knew, but it's more and more obvious to him that he is the guy who can get things done. He is better at it than anybody. He can talk his way into a job. He can talk this guy into doing this stuff. The only person he's not been able to really manipulate like that is Mike. Yeah. Jimmy's a smooth talker.
But nobody really manipulates Mike.
Well, right. But yeah, they pass. The cousins are coming in. And then we see that they've came in there to get Dr. C. And they're taking him to Nacho. They took him to Nacho. And so he's with Nacho and they're in a car and it's all.
So how do the cousins know Dr. Caldera? Just by him being involved in the criminal fraternity?
Yeah, it must be. But I don't know. Maybe they don't. Maybe Nacho knows Dr. Caldera because he was the one talking to Nacho. He didn't tell the cousins, don't involve me anymore. Don't show your face anymore. He told Nacho that. So maybe Nacho told him where to take him.
Yeah,
I don't
know. Nacho was in no condition, I don't think, to say, get me to the vet at 28 Main Street. Like, they knew.
That's a good point.
I think. I don't know. Maybe he was, but maybe that would explain it. But it seems like he was pretty out of it.
Yeah, and who would they go to? Because Hector's not around. Arturo's gone. Who would they go to find out who to take him to?
That's a good point. Maybe he had to tell them. Maybe that is why they're there.
I don't know. That's a great question, though. But Nacho has not spent this time in between these scenes healing at all. He's definitely on the downslope. He's looking rough. They get him into some dirty-looking warehouse. I think it's a Jiffy Lube, they end up saying later on, and they fix him right up good as new, and he walks out. No, they don't. But they are working on him, and then we see the cousin actually pumping his blood from his arm into Nacho's arm. That was pretty cool. The vets calls the cousin Yul Brynner and says that Nacho's lucky that he's O negative, so everything should be okay.
Is O negative common?
Oh, well, no, not so much. O positives, it's common-ish, but not real common. O positives, the most common. O negative is the universal donor. So anybody, any other blood type can take O negative blood.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why he can take his blood, although that's usually reserved for pretty desperate situations to do it arm to arm like that. But the doctor goes in, he's talking to Nacho now, he's done, and he says that by the sniff test, his bowel wasn't perforated. But he can't guarantee it, and if it was, this wound's going to start to leak, and he's going to die. And gut wounds are really bad. If your bowel is perforated from a situation, well, for any reason, a ruptured appendix, certainly any kind of trauma like a gunshot wound, it is a nasty, nasty situation inside your whole abdominal cavity.
Yeah, so he says, go see a real doctor or you'll die. Mm-hmm. But we know Nacho's not going to go to a real doctor. Like, hey, doc, take a look at this. I got a shot the other day. You know, normal day at work, gunfight. He can't go to work. It's kind of a half humorously given warning to, or almost a washing his hands of it, warning to Nacho. Well, we know Nacho's not going to go later to get that checked out at a real hospital.
Well, yeah, except or unless Nacho or somebody up the chain has somebody more that is a real doctor.
Well, like that other doctor we know. But I was wondering if maybe that's what happens to Nacho.
I don't know.
Although we do see Nacho in the next ones, he looks fairly healthy, so.
He looks better. He looks better. But that's a really, really serious thing. So even though Nacho is patched up, we don't know until we do see the next ones.
And this still Dr. Joe DeRosa is kind of a smarmy, smart-ass, joke-cracking guy, too. Like, this seems almost jokishly said in a jokish way to him.
Yeah. I mean, you know, hey, Yul Brynner over here has got O negative. He was able to hook you up. I mean, yeah, it's like very lighthearted in a situation that's not lighthearted at all.
Lots of comedians in Breaking Bad / Better Call Saul, Michelle.
Well,
Joe DeRosa, Huel, Bill Burr, Jimmy.
That's a good point.
Comedian. And who else? Probably a couple other we're forgetting.
Well, we got a little comic relief in the next scene when the guy goes to break in to Neff Copiers. And this is where I actually made the note that I'm starting to feel like that we're contrasting the seriousness of the cartel and where we know Saul is headed to how light what Jimmy is actually involved in at this point. Because it was cartoonish, but if I didn't know if this robber was going to kill the guy on Jimmy's behalf. You never know. I mean, we didn't know. And that could have taken this kind of lighthearted little trinket robbery into a whole different realm. And I was really concerned about that. But it was funny. He goes in and he tries to do this, and it turns out that the Neff guy is spending the night in his office because his wife is mad because he gifted her with a vacuum cleaner.
Yeah, more Breaking Bad here, Michelle. First of all, did you notice who that robber was?
I couldn't place him.
He was part of the Vominos Pest guy team that when they moved their meth-making operation to houses,
right.
He was one of those guys.
Oh, that's good. That's a good catch, Mike.
And the fact that the gift was a vacuum, with the disappearer was the vacuum guy.
Right.
It almost makes you wonder if he got the vacuum from that Robert Forster disappearer guy.
That's
Did you
funny.
Get mad if you got a vacuum, Michelle, for a Mother's Day present or whatever the occasion was?
You know, that's funny because no. I am such a practical gift, wanter gift. Yeah, that's what I want. All of these women who are like, you better not get me anything that plugs in. I'm like, are you kidding? I mean, that's not me. No, I would love that. But
why are you wearing a tiara in your Skype picture then?
Just I don't know. I like looked at the picture. Am I going, what? No. No tiara. But it's just kind of funny. The guy, he gets on the phone with his wife, and she chews him out, and she hangs up. So he goes over, and he orders a pizza. And meanwhile, the robber, what did you say his name was? Do we know his name?
I don't know his name. I think his name was Ira in the Vominos Pest thing.
Okay. But he
Michelle,
is...
do you throw your husband out of the house when you have a... When you're angry, I'm stupid to nitpick this, I guess, but he gets, it's such an old fashioned punishment, it seems.
Well, in a way, it's kind of not an old fashioned punishment because would a 50s housewife kick her husband out for bringing her a vacuum?
That's what I'm saying.
Know. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. The whole thing was. We kind of talked about how they seemed very behind the times, and maybe it's just another, I don't know. I think it was just an excuse
to
have
the copier guys are behind the times.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, in every way, in their business model, in their dress, in the decor of the office, in just everything.
Well, he's listening to Stephen Covey's sales tip tapes, too, taking notes. By the way, the pizza was also Breaking Bad. That was the place where Walt got the pizza that he threw up on the garage.
Oh, was it the same place?
Vincenzo's or something. Yeah, some
cool. You've
Italian.
Got all these. You got caught all these things.
That's no, I really got Reddit, good. Michelle.
Oh. But yeah, Mr. Neff, he's finishing this whole cheese pizza and listening to the motivational time management matrix Stephen Covey tapes. Did you ever listen to Stephen Covey, Zig Ziglar, Tony Robbins, any of those?
Yeah, but well, like in 1978 or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Not in a while.
Yeah, it's been a day or two. So then I'm already calling him Saul. I caught myself doing this when I was making the notes, writing Saul in place of Jimmy. And I don't know if that's because they're brilliant and they're kind of turning him into that, and that's what I'm seeing as I'm doing this, or if I'm just out of it. It could be either one equally. But the guy has called Ira, and I do think that's his name in this, has called Jimmy and told him that he's got to come get him out of there because he's stuck. And it's just, it's funny. I literally laughed. It's like, okay, we've got this real serious stuff, and then I'm actually laughing in this point because it's just comical. And
you might also call that a Breaking Bad moment too, because remember when Walt calls Saul to help with Hank at the trailer, get him out of that.
That's, yeah, yes, I think that's another nod toward Breaking Bad. I do think we really edged more toward Breaking Bad maybe in this episode.
So some people, Michelle, are actually complaining about this, like there's too much Breaking Bad. Like, where's Jimmy? We want story Better Call Saul, not just rehash Breaking Bad. It's too much. We're getting swamped over by Breaking Bad-ish actors coming in and scenes and replications of what happened in Breaking Bad. They want more Jimmy and Better Call Saul. I don't mind. I think they're doing it at the right amount. I really think it's okay with what they're introducing back to, or reminding us of Breaking Bad with all these people and scenes.
Well, this is Jimmy's story. This is Saul's story, right? Saul's going to have pieces of Breaking Bad become more and more a part of his life as he becomes more and more Saul. If he didn't, and all these people just fell into his life suddenly, that wouldn't seem authentic. I agree with you. I think it's perfect the way they do that. But Jimmy devises this plan to turn the guy's car alarm on. Hopefully the guy will go out to turn his car alarm off. And Ira will be able to escape, but the guy doesn't. He uses his remote, and so Jimmy has to do it again, but this time he goes overboard and has the car rolling away, so the guy will have to chase his car. The guy would have to know something was going on with his car. Somebody had done that, though.
Jimmy's playing with fire here, too, because car alarm's going off at night. Second time. I mean, who knows, the guy doesn't just call the police. And if Jimmy gets arrested, he's cooked, man.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's another thing that we got to talk about is that Jimmy's on probation. And if he's been doing public service. If he gets in trouble in this year, it's going to be a bad day for Jimmy. So that's another good point. They walk away, and it's lighthearted, but it was a little bit scarier scene than I anticipated, only because I didn't know which way it was going to go. And if Ira had ended up killing this Neff guy to get out of there, that would have been a completely different ending to this.
Yeah, I never got that, though. I never got that the Vominos Pest guys were more than, of course, what's his name? Todd. Turns out to be a murderer. But the Vominos Pest guys did seem like kind of robbers more than murderer, killing criminals.
Sure, but in that situation, when you're backed against the wall and been hunkering under this desk for who knows how long, I don't know. I was a little worried. And plus, he wasn't really good. He left his glove over on the shelf where the Hummels were. So he ended up being able to get it, but I don't know. He just wasn't really good at what he did. He didn't notice that there was a bed made up on the couch when he went in. It's just a complete contrast of what we're seeing with the other side, the cartel side, and how attention, how detail-oriented they are, how much they pay attention to the details. And then this guy, is he just seems buffoonish in the stuff he does comparatively.
He's no Mike Ehrmantraut for sure.
He's no Ehrmantraut. And then we see Bolsa calling Gus and telling him about the Salamancas being hit yesterday. And Bolsa tells him to run dummy loads because the product was taken too, of course. You know, you wouldn't do that and not take the product, I don't guess. Until they make sure that they're not compromised. And Gus tells him it's not even going to be a week before the dealers run dry. And so Bolsa comes up with the idea that he needs to find a supplier on his side and cut a deal. And Gus is like, Don Eladio wouldn't like that. And Bolsa goes, you leave that to me. So you think this was Gus' idea?
Exactly. That was okay. Gus's plan all along. He wants them to come up, them, quote, air quote, unquote, to come up with a local supplier, which is exactly why Gus is meeting with Gail and planning to be the local supplier eventually. And then he's going to let Don Juan will handle a lot. I mean, he's going to let his competition wipe themselves out while he finds his own supplier. And he essentially doesn't become a cog in their wheel. He becomes the machine himself.
Right.
So it's pretty brilliant, pretty chess movie. Like he's, you know, four or five chess moves ahead of all these other guys thinking.
Yeah, he really, and it's pretty deep stuff. He's got this, it's like these little ant trails that he's worked on forever, and things seem to be, lining up the way he wants them to go.
Well, he also leverages opportunity. Like, he probably didn't plan Nacho exactly to come out the way it did. He took the opportunity of Nacho and machined it into what he could benefit from. So that was brilliant too. Like he's not just a good planner, he's a good adaptor. And he leveraged that situation to his advantage. And now he's got that working for him too. So he's pretty smart on all sides.
You see, I just think that's perfect because it's just like you said, he used this bad situation. And I don't think he planned that either. Arturo's the one who strong-armed the people for the drugs, but he handled that situation and then used the situation in place of freaking out over it or just trying to patch it up. He actually turned it into a positive for him and his business. But then he walks into the school.
But Michelle, and, I will also say that Arturo, Gus made that strong arm situation happen with Arturo.
Like, by giving it to him the first time?
Make them look like they're only going to get five and then get six. Make them force it to be... Like, I think Gus made that plan out, too.
Well, they were only supposed to get five. Five was the number. Hector wanted six the first time that they went because he was, like, trying to show Gus who was in charge. But with Hector down, and evidently, I mean, in my mind anyway, Gus is having to make this stuff up somewhere. Hector was trying to impress Don Eladio, and so he was just going to take more of Gus' stuff. The deal was for five. That's certainly how I took it. And then Arturo was trying to be as strong-armish as Hector, I guess just to prove they were still strong, even though Hector was down. Or who knows? Who knows why Arturo did that?
Right, but Victor and Tyrus can't agree to move it from five to six without Gus already. And this was totally planned by Gus. They're going to want one more, make them look like they can only get five. I believe that Gus was behind that, too, because I don't think Victor and Tyrus make that snap decision on the spot without Gus. That would get them in big trouble with Gus if Gus only wanted them to have five and they gave him six.
Well, Gus was there, first of all, and I'm sure they had that conversation ahead of time. They got six last time. That'll never happen again. But if they demand it, give it to them, and we'll handle it, or whatever. That's how I saw that happening. I don't know that Gus necessarily set them up, but I don't know, maybe. Maybe he did. But then we see Gus walk in.
And Michelle, I also don't think that's why they killed Arturo. I think Gus killed Arturo to solidify Nacho in his power. You are owned by me now because I know the secret about you. And to prove how serious I am about it, I'm going to murder your partner in front of you. I don't think that was retribution for getting 6 instead of 5.
Oh, my gosh. I completely disagree with that. I think it was total retribution. I think Arturo would have been fine. I think Gus was looking for his moment to handle Nacho, and this just happened to be it. But
I don't think so. I think I see it as an opportunity that arose that he took advantage of. And he couldn't take advantage of Nacho with Arturo around. And it proved to Nacho how serious he was by the added cherry on top of just murdering him cold-bloodedly in front of him.
Why couldn't he have taken advantage of Nacho with Arturo around? Certainly not in the same space when he let him know.
Because Arturo didn't know about Nacho's plan with Hector.
Right, but what I'm saying is he could have had Nacho working Arturo. I don't think Arturo was necessarily a detriment to what Nacho could be good for, working for Gus, being this double spy or whatever, however you'd want to put that. I wouldn't see Arturo as being any kind of wall in the way. I don't know. You certainly could be right. I just didn't see it that way. But then we see Gus walk in and to the chemistry lab, and it's Gale. And you want to talk about a nod back to Walt? That was kind of craziness. Gale's explaining to him what... Okay, so Gale's sitting there working on something, and Gus says, "What is it?" And Gale goes into this whole... how you dissolve salt in water and the different things you can do to the water to make the water hold more salt. And then he says he is trying that with benzodiazepine. So that was an interesting little thing he was doing.
So what's benzodiazepine or whatever it is?
If you hadn't asked me, isn't it?
I thought that was his coffee machine. His coffee thing that he impressed Walt with at the lab, the super lab. I thought he was working on the coffee machine. You stir a liquid, it can hold more chemical than if it's not stirred. And that somehow made it, he could make better coffee. But I thought that thing looked like his coffee machine in the super lab. Because he can't be making, it's not a meth thing. It's not an illegal thing in the middle of the lab in the college.
Oh, sure it is. Sure, what he's working on is illegal. Benzodiazepine are like Xanax. And he's trying to find a way to get more Xanax to be suspended in whatever solution he's working on. Evidently, there's only, and I don't know anything about this, but there's some, much like he explained it, you can only, excuse me, dilute so much into a solution.
Yeah, but I mean, if it's a step in the meth making process, it's a very removed one, a concealed one, because it's obviously in New Mexico State University can't be making meth to prove a chemistry principle in your class. It has to be something. Maybe it contains a chemical that's used in meth, but it's so isolated that it's, you know, you would never say, wait a minute, our professor's making meth here.
Well, we see that's not necessarily true a little bit later on, but no, I don't think it has anything to do with meth. I think it's just showing that Gale is open to and curious about how he can manipulate drugs to make them different, better, whatever. I don't know. But that didn't have anything to do with the coffee. But maybe it did. Maybe that's how he ended up with the coffee thing. Because that's
couldn't you make coffee better the same way you make drugs better, just by purity and enhancing certain characteristics that make its flavor, you know, the way it is? You make it better. You make it instead of 39% good coffee, you make it 91% good coffee.
Yeah, that's 91% pure. That's interesting. And a lot of people talk about the different ways of coffee and which is better. And what I guess, the same thing like you're talking about would be my guess about it, is that how much you can actually infuse in the water and what's the right amount to make it the best cup of coffee. That's a good point.
But he's testing something that Gus had brought him, and that's all Gus wants him to do is give him a report of the test results.
And it's meth, right?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, it's his meth samples, because it's nodding back to Walt again. He's telling him how pure it is, and the best purity he's gotten in all these samples is 67%. And a lot of it's like down to 30-something percent. I think with Walt, what was it, 99-point-something or 97-or-something percent? I think the 97%, if I remember right, Walt called garbage or something. But this is like 39 to 58% pure, basically, for Gus's samples. And Gail's telling him, this is not good. It's not even close to good. It's really bad. And then he tells him, this is why I think he absolutely could do something. He tells him right here, he says, I could make a kilo in just a few days and do a much better job. Let me do it. And, yeah. And Gus is like, no, no. And talks about something else. And he goes, no, let me do it. Let me do it. And he goes, no. And he gets very serious about it. He tells him that he was meant for better things.
Interesting how Gail is pushing for a way into something that Nacho is dreaming of getting out of.
Right.
And Gus says, I own you, Nacho. But Gail, he pushes back and says, I won't let you in yet. It was such a paradox, almost the exact opposite ends of the spectrum of their involvement.
Yeah, exactly. But we have to think that Gail is just goofy to want into this, right? He doesn't know, I don't think. I don't think he realizes.
I don't think he realizes the total extent of the picture, but he knows he's getting involved in a criminal activity.
Well, sure, but it's so goofy. I mean, he goes back to singing his periodic table with his Hooked on Phonics cassette. I mean, it's just goofiness. They're showing him as just being silly.
He's basically a very happy guy until what happens to him happens to him. He's happy in his stupid little apartment with his little figurines and his goofy music. And
right.
He's very happy singing. People that sing out loud in a public place are pretty happy people, I think. I don't think he's crazy. I think he's just pretty happy.
No, I don't think he's crazy. I just think he's silly. I mean, he's very smart, but he's just, it just seems like the seriousness hasn't realized it.
Yeah, he's definitely quirky, but my basic takeaway is that he's happy. I mean, he wants to make himself more than what he is now, but it actually ends up being a lot less. You know, maybe that's a thing to think about in life. Like, just look at where you are and see what level of happiness you have, and, you know, striving for more and doing things that get you into trouble because you're striving for that more maybe aren't the best decisions to make.
Which we see with Kim, I think, is how she's feeling too. So that's a good point here with Gail. And then we go back to Kim, and she's going over some paralegal work. It's in the morning, but Jimmy slept late. And at first I was thinking, okay, this is out of character, but he was up all night. And that's why he slept late, because he was up all night getting Ira out of Neff's office. And Kim decides it's time to give him the information that she went over with Howard. And, okay, what'd you think about this situation? What'd you think about this scene?
Well, this is also one of the mysteries. I don't remember if I talked about it at the beginning of our podcast here, but this is mysterious to this letter. She tells Jimmy the will, and he's like, yeah, whatever, $5,000. I guess I'll pay my credit card with that. Like, he's not really impressed or unimpressed or slighted by it, or he doesn't show that he's slighted by it.
But yeah, he kind of does, though. He looks like when she tells him the amount, he winces like he was slapped. But that's the only indication that he gives of anything. And then he just continues on.
So this letter is mysterious to me a little bit. I think I know what the writer's intentions are, but in fact, I wrote here because we Michelle, you and I do the Affair podcast, and I actually wrote this in my notes that in the Affair we default to the dumb, like maybe Kim switched the letter and gave Jimmy a simple little happy, you know, happy-ish one that when he reads it she cries because she feels guilty about it, but in Better Call Saul we default to smart. And I think that this is the smart. We see Kim crying because she sees a side of Jimmy that she doesn't like as he reads this letter.
Yeah, good. Yeah, okay, good. Because that's what I thought, too. She was looking at him. If you're just hearing something, you probably are looking away when somebody's reading you something, or at least not staring at the person's face who's reading it. That's exactly what I thought, too. She got upset, and at first I thought she was upset about the content, that it was touching to her, and I think she was at the very first, but then I think she was really upset over Jimmy's lack of reaction at all to it.
Yeah, it's all, my take is it's all about her interpretation of Jimmy being this new side of Jimmy that she doesn't know yet, and she doesn't like, and she's not happy with it.
Right. Well, she's seen the devastating effects of this greed, essentially, in every aspect of the lives of the people around her, Chuck's and Jimmy's and now Kevin's and her own with the car accident and everything. And I think that she is coming to realize that she doesn't want to do this. This is that there is more to life, and this isn't it for her.
Yeah, and more than greed, I think it's emotional indifference on the part of Jimmy. Like, oh, well, he's gone now, and let's move on. And this letter is kind of a heartfelt letter from Chuck to Jimmy. It's way in the past. It's like his mailroom days, it seems like, because he's proud of him and all that. And Jimmy just tosses it like, oh, well, whatever. And I think she doesn't like that. I think this indifference about her boyfriend slash whatever he is, fiance, not technically probably, but long-term boyfriend guy, that she doesn't like this side of him that she sees that's new to her.
I absolutely agree. Jimmy, I didn't mean his greed like over what he wanted from Chuck. I just meant their overall greed in life. Jimmy's told her what he did to get the Sandpiper case resolved, and that was a really bad thing, even though he made it up. And just and with Kevin's greed and her own, I don't know, maybe greed's not the right word, but she needed to make the money to keep the office, and then she had the car accident. It's just like everybody wants more and more and more and more of this, and I just don't think she's putting the value on it that everybody else is.
Yeah, I still say it's Jimmy's emotions about Chuck and not really greed at all. Because when Jimmy was mourning about Chuck and he was kind of off and quiet by himself and she went and helped him, that brought them really close. And now when Jimmy's indifferent and like, okay, I can't stop eating my cereal to read this important letter. I can't even stop taking a bite of cereal every 15 seconds.
His
indifference is more than annoying to her. It's like telling, like, wow, this was the guy I was helping get through his grief over this, and now he's just, like, breezing over it. I think that was the message.
Yeah, but maybe she doesn't realize that this isn't just an emotional reaction. Maybe she even feels sorry for Jimmy because she feels like this is how he's going to handle this for a while. He's decided to cut off his emotion because he can't handle his emotion. I don't know. But she goes into her bedroom and she closes the door, at least attempts, half closes it as Jimmy goes to her. She does not want Jimmy. Jimmy's surprised to see her crying. He's he's moved by that, I think. So that's why I'm saying, I mean, I think Jimmy is leaving us because
it was a rift. It's a rift for Kim and Jimmy. It's a rift. It's where they were brought together in earlier episodes because of Chuck, and now they're being pushed apart because of their seeing how their reactions are about Chuck. So it's a break between them, clearly.
I think so too. I agree. And that was the end of this episode.
Yeah, so the next one's Michelle. I saw that courtroom scene. I didn't really know what was going on in there, but I saw that. And then the cousins see the silver car that they talk about. Nacho mentions a silver car.
The Firebird, yep.
Jimmy has a new job. I didn't get exactly what that was, but I saw that.
Well, he's telling Kim he does. But does he? Is his new job selling Hummels on eBay? I don't know.
I don't know. They flash through these next on so quickly. Mm-hmm. And then Mike says, this guy's story changes every time you hear it. And then Jimmy says his plans have changed. So I don't know if Mike's referring to Jimmy or what. But and then Gus is telling somebody to tell him, if you have something to say, you better tell me now.
Yep.
And then all the various guns and explosions that probably are part of that episode coming up.
Right. And then we see the cousins covered in blood, and one of them's holding a gun.
Not the cousins.
The cousins, those kind souls. And a shootout, and we see Nacho in the shootout. He's holding his stomach, but he does look, from a distance at least, better. And, of course, then the explosions on top of buildings. So something's going to go down next week. Though, it was, you're right, these were really short upcomings, really short, like a lot of clips in like 30 seconds. But it looks like if it's going to follow the clips that it's going to be much more cartel stuff than Jimmy stuff. And it's at this point that I'm like really missing Gene. I want to go back to Gene, at least for a little while, and I don't think they're going to do that. But anyway, next week is episode 4 called Talk. So we got that.
All right, Michelle, we'll check in with you for 404.
Okay, we'll do it then.
See you then.
Okay.